morning, everyone.
Morning.
Good morning.
Say welcome to the Court of Appeals, but I guess I should say welcome to your libraries or living rooms or bathrooms or wherever you might be at this point. The case scheduled next for our oral calendar is PEXA v. Disabled Veterans of America, or I'm sorry, Disabled American Veterans of Minnesota Foundation. I just want to state for the record, as the parties are aware, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is declining to hold live oral arguments at the Minnesota Judicial Center here in St. Paul or elsewhere, including in St. Cloud and other places around the state where we traditionally hold argument. And we're doing so for the good of the public, for the good of the parties, the attorneys, and court staff, in light of the ongoing national and Minnesota pandemic state of emergency. We are therefore entertaining this argument by a video conferencing tool, WebEx to be particular, with none of the judges or the parties or the participants here in the same precise location, at least not in the same actual room. Some of us are here in the Judicial Center. The technology is not perfect, so I'll advise the parties just to be aware of the fact that there may be lag time from now and again, depending on our individual bandwidth and the technology. So the time that something is spoken may not necessarily be the same time that it's heard. Please bear that in mind as we engage in this discussion. But in keeping with due process, the proceedings are public, which means that the audio recording of these proceedings will be made available to anyone to hear on the judiciary website, just as we have in recent past with other oral arguments. The rules of presentation, however, are unchanged. So each party will have 15 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. And be mindful of the timing restrictions as they're indicated by my marshals. Very high-tech timing device there. You see his telephone and you see he has the very good, the, what do you call those, model hands that he's paid nothing extra for, those wonderful hands that are demonstrating the clock. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Okay. My name is Stephen Knudsen. I represent appellants Bert and Catherine PEXA. This is an appeal from the district court's order and judgment dismissing appellant's complaint with prejudice. District court's order and judgment was based on a summary judgment. It was based on the interpretation of a contract language, the contract for deed at the heart of this. Standard with the summary judgment and the contract interpretation is a de novo review. The relief sought is that the appellants are requesting reversal of the trial court's order judgment, has been a complete remand of the case for trial, and a reinstatement of the temporary restraining order, which should just happen automatically on a remand. The order and judgment dismissing appellant's complaint failed to properly apply the summary judgment standard, and it also failed to properly analyze the contract for deed language. This case concerns a half interest in a family century farm of 160 acres in Miltona, Minnesota. That means the farm.
Mr. Knudsen, we're familiar with the facts, and I think it would be helpful to really jump to the heart of the issue, which is really interpretation of paragraphs 4 and 5 of the contract. And I guess the first question I have is, I just want to confirm, it appears in your brief that you are arguing that the contract language is unambiguous. Correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. The under section 4, paragraph 4, the specific language says there shall be no payments of interest or principal for the first 5 years. The first payment shall be made on May 25, 1990.
Okay. And so paragraph 5 talks about prepayments. And would you agree that a prepayment is different than a payment?
It would be, but paragraph 5 does not apply because the first part of paragraph 5 says, unless otherwise provided in this contract.
Right. And paragraph 5 uses standard language, and that's standard language that is used, commonly used in these types of contracts. And none of that language has been changed by the parties, correct?
No. Under section excuse me, paragraph four, the parties did change that. They had a specific term in there. It says payments shall be credited first to interest and remainder to principal.
Okay. So, and so you point to the language on paragraph five, the very beginning phrase that says, unless otherwise provided in this contract. Where in this contract, and including in paragraph four, does it mention anything about prepayments?
It mentions forbidding any payments before May 25, 1990.
But does it, it talks about payments, but payments is a different term than prepayments. Prepayments is something that's defined in section, in paragraph five. Where in the agreement, including paragraph four, though, does it talk about prepayments?
It says, well, again, there shall be no payments of interest or principal for the first 5 years.
Right, but that just means that the party doesn't, that appellant does not have to make any payments. But paragraph five says if appellants want to make a prepayment, they shall have the right to do that. So they can make a prepayment anytime they want.
The language, payments shall be credited to first interest and remainder to principal, would apply to any kind of payments. There doesn't seem to be any limiting language in that statement.
Are you talking about the language in paragraph four? Well, but paragraph five with respect to prepayments has contrary language and specific language as to how prepayments are handled and credited.
I believe that any kind of payments would be covered under the paragraph four language.
So basically, the way I interpret your argument is you're saying paragraph five doesn't apply at all. You're basically writing paragraph five out of the contract?
Yes, Your Honor.
So how do you square that with case law that says we don't do that? We read and interpret contracts to give every single provision meaning. You're basically saying paragraph five has no meaning whatsoever, contrary to case law requiring us to give every provision meaning.
That is correct, Your Honor, unless the contract's specific terms override that particular paragraph.
But why can't we read the two of them in conjunction? Because it seems to me that paragraph four just simply talks about, it's entitled purchase price. Here's how the payments are going to be made. And you don't have to make any payments for the first 5 years. Paragraph five on prepayments says, if you want to make any prepayments, if you want to make any earlier payments, here's how it works. So why can't the two be read in conjunction, which is what we are supposed to do? We're supposed to give every provision meaning.
The language under paragraph four says there shall be no payments of interest or principal for the first 5 years. That would include any kind of prepayments.
Mr. Knutson, then that argument, would that not mean that even accepting your argument that at a minimum paragraph five would kick in, would be effective on May 25, 1990? In other words, if the sole basis for your argument is no, paragraph four says no payment shall be made for 5 years, and that's the reason paragraph five does not apply, would it naturally follow that when that five-year period ends, paragraph five then becomes effective?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the parties modified the contract with the 1988 checks. They did a modification of the original terms of the contract. So the 88 checks were actually payments on the contract. They were not prepayments.
So if I understand correctly, you're indicating a modification from what we are looking at in paragraphs 4 and 5, or an additional part of your argument, and was it summary judgment that paragraph 5 should be disregarded as a matter of law?
That's correct, Your Honor.
District Court make that determination as part of its evaluation?
It noted that the payment term under section, it's paragraph 4, was in there, but it didn't apply that, as far as I could tell.
Mr. Knutson, I just want to go back to my previous question. I'm not sure if you answered it, but is the word prepayments found anywhere in paragraph 4?
It is not, Your Honor.
Is the word prepayments, other than in paragraph 5, is it found anywhere else in the contract?
Just under section 18, which says that the headings don't have any legal effect. But besides that,
But the term prepayment is not just in the heading of paragraph 5.
That is correct.
It's also in the text. So why does, I don't understand your point about paragraph 18.
The checks that were paid in 1988 were not prepayments. They were actual.
Oh, I'm trying to understand your textual argument.
Okay.
About, so what is it that the text of paragraph 18 says that matters to your argument?
I guess it doesn't, Your Honor. It's there. You're correct. There are section. Paragraph 5 says that the within that paragraph, it does say prepayments.
And the appellant had the ability to either prepay either fully or partially, right?
Not according to the original contract. The easiest way to think of it is, who would win in court under the original contract? So if Daryl had demanded a payment, which he did, and the appellants had said, no, we don't have to make a payment until May 25, 1990, there is no way that Daryl could have forced them to make the payment. So if the parties had, if the appellants had tried to make the payment before 1990, then Daryl could have said, I don't want it, you can't pay me. And then.
Right. But under that hypothetical, I think the answer to that is yes, because under paragraph 5, it says that the princesses shall have the right to fully or partially prepay. That's not may, it's shall. So appellants had the right to make any type of prepayment. If appellants wanted to pay off the entire thing without having to pay any interest, under paragraph 5, they would have had the ability to do that.
I believe that the language, or the paragraph 4 language saying there shall be no payments, would control that.
But that just goes to the regular payments that are made when the regular payments start. That just goes to payments. That doesn't go to prepayments. Paragraph 5 goes to prepayments. And typically in an agreement, if you have a prepayment, you can do that, but there's typically a penalty. And this contract says there's no penalty. You can prepay either part of it or the whole thing.
I believe that introduce some ambiguity then into the contract, which would mean that summary judgment is not appropriate.
Where would be the ambiguity? What would be the two reasonable interpretations of paragraph 5 that says appellants shall have the right to prepay?
Then it's a factual dispute as to whether or not the 1988 payments are prepayments or regular payments.
How is that a factual dispute? We're just talking about the contract language of whether or not a party has the right to make a payment, and the language is pretty clear. It says shall. How is that a factual issue rather than a legal issue?
As it also says, well, the intent of the parties would be, did the parties consider the 1988 checks payments or a prepayment, if your analysis would be correct?
Well, payments are not required for the first 5 years. So it would be anything that's made before then would be a prepayment, meaning paragraph 5 applies, and that gives the absolute right to appellants to make any prepayments.
Unless the parties modified the contract so that the 1988 payments were payments on the contract, not prepayments.
If there's a modification to the contract, where is the writing indicating that the parties intended to modify any of the language of either paragraph 4 or paragraph 5?
That would be in the 88 checks themselves, Your Honor.
Where is that in the agreement itself, either in paragraph 4 or paragraph 5?
It would be a modification based on the checks and an oral modification of the contract.
Are oral modifications of a land transfer or property, real property transfer, valid?
I believe they are, Your Honor. I did the statute of frauds analysis in the second motion in limine. Documentation. I keep going.
That's entirely up to you. You have about 30 seconds left if you'd like to wrap it up, or bear in mind that you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. If you'd like to pause and regroup, you can certainly do that.
Okay, I believe I will just do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Yes, Your Honors. Robert Hartley for Disabled American Veterans of Minnesota Foundation. And so the respondents believe and agree with the court that the paragraph 4 and paragraph 5 are distinct and that they can be read together. The language is clear in paragraph 4, the payment language. It was drafted by an attorney, and so the language is straightforward and easily understood, and that there are specific parts that are indented in the language to indicate that it definitely is applying to the purchase price. With regards to the payment, shall be credited first to interest and remainder per principal. Again, it's within paragraph 4. And then if you look down at paragraph 5, where it talks about prepayments, it distinguishes prepayments with principal installments. And so while paragraph 4 talks about payments, and in paragraph 5, they're considered principal installments. The installment and payment is the same thing. So these are separate and distinct paragraphs that can be read together. And the district court's interpretation is the only reasonable interpretation, because if you look at the appellant's interpretation, where again, you're removing paragraph 5, that's not a reasonable for any number of reasons, particularly given that the purpose of the contract is to transfer a family farm to the next generation, and they do that with favorable terms. You know, a $5 down payment, a 5-year deferral period, a term of 37 years, an interest rate that's well below the current interest rate at the time. So it's this idea that they wanted to ensure that the family farm was able to be transferred, and the prepayment was a part of that.
Mr. Hartley, again, what does the record indicate as to how the parties considered the 1988 payment? In other words, did essentially the parties move up the interest and principal, or was there a calculation of principal only? Is there any evidence in the record that was part of the summary judgment in front of the judge as to how the parties actually considered those payments?
There was no record of that. These 1988 payments arose during the probate of Daryl Pex's estate. And it was looking at the checks, they're just made out to Daryl Pexa, and then one made out to Marlis Pexa, the wife. But again, they also, these folks were also involved in a farming partnership. So it's unclear what the reason for those checks are, but there's no indication in the record of the parties in any way modifying the contract at all. And so there's that.
So is the point, though, that for purposes of summary judgment, your client presumed, allowed the court to presume it was a prepayment or at least an early payment in any event on this contract, such that summary judgment was appropriate?
That's right, because if the jury decides that these checks were actually prepayments, well, then they're going to get applied in accordance with paragraph 5, where it's to the inverse order of the maturity, which means it goes back to year 37 and is eliminated that way. So even if they are considered prepayments, that still doesn't fulfill the contract. I'm looking at my notes, but unless there's other questions, I think that again, the interpretation is straightforward. And again, looking at what the appellants are arguing, that interpretation is not reasonable. And so then the court was correct in concluding that there's no genuine issue for material fact on going to trial. And so again, the respondents believe that the district court's decision should be affirmed.
Looks like there's no more questions. So if you have no more argument, we will make sure that I'm good. My microphone is on. If you'd like to rest the rest of your argument on your brief, then thank you for your argument. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Just that factual determination of whether or not the 1988 checks were payments or prepayments should be given to the jury, I guess. I don't think there was any new issues raised with respondents' arguments.
Okay, well, thank you, counsel, for your, does that conclude your rebuttal?
I guess I would just like to summarize again. There's either the contract language was not ambiguous, in which case the payments on the contract should not be applied under section or paragraph 5. If the contract was ambiguous, then summary judgment's not appropriate. In either case, the payments or how the contract or how the parties wanted to deal with the payments, they wanted to credit at first the interest and the remainder to principal. I'm not so sure that the parties themselves would have understood the difference between a prepayment and a payment. They were just farmers, and
their understanding doesn't bear upon. I mean, if the language is plain and unambiguous, and we can read it and understand it, then arguments about whether one or the other understood the meaning of it really wouldn't drive our decision, would it?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I mean, whether or not the parties understood that a prepayment was different than a payment.
I mean, I didn't see an argument of a mistake, mutual mistake.
No, the argument is whether or not they modified the contract based on the 88 checks. which would make the 88 checks actual payments on the contract subject to paragraph 4. Are there any other questions?
It doesn't appear as if there are any more questions from the bench.
I don't believe I have anything else then, Your Honor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Knutson, Mr. Hartley, for your arguments, for your briefing in this matter, and for your accommodation in these unusual times to actually present your argument by WebEx. I think this actually goes much better than just getting the briefs. I always think oral argument is a helpful opportunity for the parties to clear up any concerns in their drafting and for the court to clear up any misunderstanding about the argument. So we appreciate your willingness to continue with your oral argument despite the circumstances. The matter is submitted and we will take it under advisement at this point. And that is the last argument that we have for today in our oral argument calendar, and we are therefore in recess. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both.